Welcome back to our Total Sense Bite Size episodes. I'm Tom Henske, and I'm here to help parents teach their kids about money. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I have with us Chris Caltabiano. He's the Chief Program Officer at the Council of Economic Education, which means a ton to me because I follow them religiously. Actually met Chris because I saw him quoted, I think it was probably in Newsday. It came from a high school friend of mine who sent off an article and said, hey, I think you'll like this one. And then I loved what Chris had to say. I reached out to Chris. In a nanosecond, he came back to me and said, sure, I'd love to help the mission. So here we are. And Chris is doing a lot of work on educational initiatives, which focus on financial literacy throughout the country at various different education levels. So a lot of the work he's doing is not just going to be for teens. It's not just going to be for elementary school. It's going to be for the whole kit and caboodle. I love your background, Chris. National Resettlement Director of the International Rescue Committee. You were in the Peace Corps in Slovakia. You have a degree in international affairs from George Washington, and you went to Boston U undergrad. Man, you've done it all. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me today.
Chris, your current role, what I understand to be, is that you're conceptualizing and then implementing all these great programs for kids impacting probably, I would say, K to 12, the way I understand it. And what I want to do is just kind of navigate the conversation today to give everyone a good understanding of what the council does, what you do, because I think some of the parents don't realize all the amazing resources that are already out there. I think I'd start by asking you just the general question of what goes on at the Council of Economic Education? You know, how is it started? Who do they serve? Can you give us the picture?
Yeah, so first I'll start with the mission. Always a good place to start. So our mission is to bring the tools and knowledge of economics and personal finance to students K-12 across the country with a goal of them being better positioned to navigate their personal lives and their lives within the community around them. Really, that K-12 focus, that focus on economics, that focus on personal finance, that's really our sweet spot. We are 75 years old. Last week we had our gala and that kicked off the celebration of our 75th anniversary. We were started in 1949 by a group of people way smarter than me who thought that this country's youth were not learning the foundations and fundamentals of economics. At that point, it was really economics focused. So they established this organization to really help make that happen. Over the years, we have obviously added personal finance. We think that there's a strong tie in those two subject areas. So we've been doing a lot of work in personal finance over the last 30, 40 years. We have literally written the book on K-12 standards in both subject areas. We've built a network of affiliates across the country who are delivering this on the ground. And we've created a whole bunch of really cool programs to help make this come to life in the classroom, both supporting educators to make them more confident, competent, capable, excited teachers of these subject areas, and also to bring programs directly to students to do the same thing. That's a quick snapshot of what we are and what we do.
You know, you think about 75 years, yeah, right? And all the stats that you see, and you'd think to yourself, wouldn't we as a country have figured it out over 75 years where we don't have some of the problems that we're having right now? But clearly you guys are blazing a trail. So mm-hmm. Tell us more about it. Tell us about your insights on current projects that you guys are working on. I want to hear how these initiatives are making their way out into the world and mm-hmm. not just, you know, in one state, but in all 50 states. So tell me about it.
Yeah. So just a real quick, you're mentioning about, you know, 75 years, you think we'd have to figure it out by now. Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, the world has changed a lot in those 75 years as well. 75 years ago, you know, there weren't any credit cards, for example. Not even 75 years ago, you go back 20 years ago, most people didn't need to think about 401ks because they had pensions, right? Companies were putting that in place. So they didn't have to think about how they were going to manage their financial lives going forward. So there has been, those are just two examples, but so much change. You know, you talk about fintech, for example, another one. There's so much change there that there's always more to bring to people. The other thing I would say is in recent years, we've really started to figure out what the fundamentals of financial education should look like. and what makes them work in the classroom. And so that's really provided a moment, I would say, to elevate what had always been a conversation somewhat in the background to a much more central part of education in this country. Some of the things that we're doing now or have been doing for some time, we do a lot of work kind of really at the highest level around, you know, advocating for more and better education. What I mean by that is looking at state level requirements to ensure that young people are having the opportunity to take this course. And I'll tell you that requirements do make a difference. And what I mean by that is if you're in a state where there is not a requirement to take personal finance as a condition of graduation, and you are in one of the poorest, say 25% of the schools in that state, you have a significantly less opportunity to even have that offered at your school. And so by putting requirements in place, you actually ensure that you are reaching all students across the state. And so that's why we push really hard at the state level for advocating to have these requirements in place, have teachers well prepared to teach them. At the highest level, reaching every single student through advocacy. Taking it down one level to the teacher, we had something like 10,000 hours of professional development last year, working with teachers on how to bring these subjects into their classroom in an interesting and exciting way to really make them come alive in the classroom. We also create tons of resources. So actually the materials that educators are bringing into the classroom, we do a ton of work around that. So that we reach probably as an entire network, somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 teachers a year. You extrapolate that out for students, it's probably around 4 million students a year that we're touching. And then we have programs directly for students. We have two student competitions that are actually the national finals will be happening over the course of the next few weeks. The National Personal Finance Challenge will be happening in 2 weeks. The finals, where we will be naming a national champion, we're going to have around 15,000, and we will have had around 15,000 students participating in that nationwide. And then our economics challenge is at the very beginning of June, same thing, naming the national champion in that. We also have a program called Invest in Girls, which is focused on high school age young women, thinking about not just their own personal finances, but how do they can envision themselves potentially making a career in the field of finance. I think it'll come as no shock to you that the data isn't great around percentage of women versus men in the finance industry. And so this program is intended to help young women see themselves and understand that the things that interest them and excite them and that they are academically strong at can actually provide them with a career in the area of finance as well. So those are the sorts of programs we do for students directly. We probably reach, I'm going to say 25 to 30,000 students directly with those programs each year as well. So that gives you kind of a big broad brushstroke of the work we do. If you think about it from the top level of every single student in the country down to the funnel of those that we're reaching with very direct programs.
Wow, that's a lot of reach. You know, you were talking about the making it mandatory, or you were implying that which states do have mandatory education versus nice to have education. Can you give our listeners any sort of feel as to across the landscape of the United States, like what does it look like right now? It's not mandatory in all 50 states, right?
It is not. And every 2 years we publish something called the Survey of the States. We just published the new one about 8 weeks ago. And what it showed is that, as of now, there are 35 states that require personal finance to be taken in some way as a condition of graduation. Let me take a second and what does it mean by in some way? In 20 of those states, it is a standalone one semester course that is dedicated specifically and only to personal finance. In the other 15 states, it's integrated in some way. I'm going to give you an example. In my backyard here in New York, there's a requirement, but it really is just like one unit within the economics class. So it's kind of giving short shrift to both economics and personal finance, in my opinion. In some cases, it's in the math curriculum. It can be in various places. But we really think that gold standard is that one semester dedicated course in personal finance. There's a lot of data and research that shows that does make a difference in downstream behaviors, and it's really at that course level that happens. And so 20 states, it's a good start. Even 35 states, a good start. Interestingly, there's been a groundswell in the last couple of years. There are actually 12 more states in this survey that have this requirement than did 2 years ago. So states are paying attention. I kind of feel like the ball is starting to roll down the hill and picking up speed as it goes. But there are still 15 states to go that have nothing. And again, those 15 states that have something but could be better. So that's where we're at in the nation.
And of those, did you say it was 26? I want to make sure I got the number. 26 where they have the mandatory standalone.
20 have the standalone requirement.
You see, I tried to add six in the course of this conversation. You see, at least I'm trending. I'm trying to get it to trend the right way.
I'd be happy to see that happen.
Yeah, you and me
the
both.
The trend is going in the right direction. And I think that's really great. You know, Connecticut, another one in my backyard, just put requirements in place last year. The class of 2027 will be required to graduate with a course in personal finance. So, you know, just another example from my backyard. Pennsylvania, same thing, just put something in place at the end of last year. So there is absolutely momentum. And again, I think part of the reason there is that momentum is that people are starting to see the evidence that it makes a difference. There's been a lot of research in recent years that show that students who have graduated having taken this in comparison to students from states that didn't tend to have higher credit scores. They tend to have lower default rates. They tend to make decisions, if they make the choice to go to college, around financing that tend to be on better terms for them. So there's all this evidence out there that's showing that there's a reason to make this real in the classroom, and you will see those outcomes down the road.
Do you see a future where there could be a standardized test for this? Like, I know my daughter's in high school and she's taking AP this and AP that. Mm-hmm. What about for personal finance?
Yeah, you know, I could see that happening. I think the one thing to remember is that in this country, education is very local. Policy is made at the state level, in some cases even at the local level. You know, with states that are very, very focused on local control. So the notion of having something standardized that everyone's going to take, never going to happen in this country. That's just not the way we do education here. That said, you know, you mentioned an AP. You know, I could see a scenario under which there are, you know, there are these offerings that can be open to anyone, and they could choose to take them. But I don't see a scenario under which every single student will be taking the same thing all the time everywhere.
Well, you started to hit on the challenges, so I want to stay on that for a second. What do you foresee as the biggest challenges that you face in implementing and scaling this sort of education in classrooms nationwide?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by saying, you know, I think we've overcome the biggest challenge, which was, you know, prove it. Why should we be doing this? And so that's a very encouraging thing that's changed, that this research has been so strong. As far as challenges, they're a couple fold. One is there are a lot of states that are local control, and they are very adamant about not telling local communities what to do and how to do it. And so putting a requirement in place is can be anathema to the thinking in particular states. And so I think, you know, that is a challenge. I would say another challenge is, where does it fit in the curriculum? It's already a very crowded space. Are you going to make teachers take on more work than they're already doing? Are you going to eliminate, you know, their prep sessions to make this happen? So kind of navigating that within states to make sure that it doesn't cause that sort of upset, I think, is important. And then once it's in place, I think the biggest challenge right now, and this is getting better, but I think it's something we need to keep working on, and that is making sure that educators are ready to teach this. There's very few scenarios under which a teacher who's preparing to be a teacher is actually studying this, you know, methods in sorts of classes. And so they oftentimes are asked to teach this once they're in the classroom, right? And so how do we make sure that they have the tools, the resources, the knowledge to bring this into the classroom in a way that makes a lot of sense? So that to me is the next biggest challenge. And that's why organizations like CE exist. And as I said, we train tens of thousands of teachers every year to help them be ready to bring this into the classroom. And so I often say that the legislation is a huge victory. I don't want to underestimate how important that is. But in many ways, it's the starting point, because once that's in place, you know, then how do you have the funding to actually, you know, get teachers through professional development, make sure that they've got the knowledge that they need to really bring this into the classroom? So that's the next challenge that we're facing, and, you know, that we're working really hard to Turn it into not a challenge, quite frankly.
So I'm going to ask you to take out your crystal ball. I'm not going to ask for a stock tip. Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
But I do want to hear about any new and emerging trends that you see in the space that we can go back and say, oh, wow, 5 years ago, Chris told us about that on that awesome podcast, Total Sense. So what are some emerging trends that you see coming?
Yeah. I am a terrible prognosticator, so I'm just going to put that right up front. I do think we will continue to see a trend where more states are doing this. I think there will be a trend where states are going to be finding ways to financially support this and not just turn this into some sort of legislation. I think that I'm not sure what AI is going to do, but there's a lot of talk about that right now. I think it's as a pedagogical tool. I think the verdict is out right now as far as what that's going to mean. But I certainly think it's going to be something that people are going to be paying attention to when it comes to teaching in the classroom. So those are a couple of things I see happening. I would also say that fintech is going to continue to become a more prominent part of people's financial lives, and so the education is going to need to keep up with those changes as it in some ways democratizes personal finance or how one manages their own personal finances. I think that trend is something that we're going to have to keep looking at as well.
So there's the speeches that I used to see going on YouTube called the Last Lecture series. And in fact, there was a book called The Last Lecture. And so, Chris, if you were giving your last lecture on this topic, what's the one key piece of financial advice that you would give to young adults and their parents on the topic?
Yeah. On the topic itself, I would say that, you know, the key is understanding that you have power over the choices that you make. And everything falls from that when it comes to personal finance. So if you are educated about, you know, the options that you have available and what they could potentially mean, you have so much power over your own financial lives. And that's at every income bracket. It really is that understanding that you have choices and you can have some power to move towards the choices that are best for you or that you think are best for you.
I know all the resources are amazing. I can tell you how many hours I've trolled around the site checking things out and just getting ideas for my own content. But share with the audience, which are mostly parents, grandparents, some high school kids, how do they think about using the CE resources? I'll put in the show notes where to find them, but give them a little quick tutorial before you hop off today.
Yeah, sure. So a couple of things. First, to parents and grandparents, I would say you should be banging on the doors of your district offices and making sure that this is happening in your schools. We often, you know, have adults ask us, what can I do to help? And frankly, you have influence in your communities. The dollars that are being spent to support education are your dollars, and you have a voice in how that happens. So that's a little off what you were saying, what you're asking for, but I think that that's an important thing that parents are advocating for this. As far as the resource side, what I would say is we have a really great website called econedlink.org. That has hundreds of resources. Now, most of them are teacher focused. And so the parents and grandparents, I would say, bring those to the teachers in your lives and show them all the really fun, cool ways that that you can learn about personal finance. You can learn about economics, ways that you wouldn't think of. You know, we've got a whole bunch of things on. We've got some really interesting cybersecurity lessons, for example, understanding how to protect yourself in the financial workspace. And one of them is based on Goldilocks and the Three Bears. So for little kids. So there are exciting, interesting ways for you to do that. So I would say go to EconEdLink. There is a drop-down menu there for parents. There are some parent resources. We don't do a ton in the parent in working with parents, but we have a financial literacy fun pack for different grade levels that you can actually use with your kids. Bring it to the dinner table or to wherever you all get together, and you can actually run some activities with them that way. So I would say look at EconEdLink. That is a really important thing. I would also say, talk to your kids and talk to your schools about participating in the Personal Finance Challenge. really, really great way to make learning about personal finance fun. And one of the great pieces of that competition is students are given a fictional family scenario. You know, dad is this, mom is that, kids are this, whatever the scenario is, it could be anything. You know, this year's, well, I'm not going to give too much away, but in previous years, it's been, families who are, you know, a single mother household. A family that's just had the situation where dad or grandpa is now living with them. It could be any sorts of scenarios. And then the kids have to help that family determine what their financial plan is going forward. And so it takes the conceptual and it makes it real. And that's one of the great things about the Personal Finance Challenge. And frankly, a ton of the resources that we have is that it takes it out of the classroom and it puts it into the real world.
Chris, am I making this up in my head, but the Family Fun Pack, I thought that you had it divided by age group, right?
Yes, we do. There's a K2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 9, 12 grade levels. So you can choose the one you want.
I can tell you, I've sent that to clients, and I have each of the PDFs. And when they say, hey, how can I talk to my kids about money? I'll send them the PDF of the Family Fun Pack. Love them. Great stuff.
Yeah. And it's free. It's free. So
imagine that.
You download it and it's available for you.
Awesome. Well, Chris, hey, first of all, great information. Second of all, I can't thank you enough for being so responsive and wanting to come on the show. I've always joked that the financial literacy community, we're a very tight-knit group and we want to help each other. And I thought it was just so awesome how you responded. Yeah, I'll be on. And thank you, thank you, thank you for all the great materials you're putting into the schools, that you're putting on the kitchen table, dinner time conversations through the Fun Pack. What you guys are doing is epic, and I really appreciate it because I see the value.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time to talk with me, Tom, and the same to you. I really appreciate the work that you do. Thanks so much for everything.
I hope you enjoyed our episode of Total Sense. A special thank you goes out to Verso Studios at the Westport Library. Tune in for our next Money Chat.